Welcome to a Juno afternoon, this slightly rainy Friday. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, and we've got a really great show today where we're going to be continuing our series on Words 101 with a conversation with storyteller Pete Griffin and also Ann Fuller. We'll get a preview of this weekend's Juno Cabaret. Patrice Helmar is going to be here to talk about her movie premiere that's happening tomorrow night at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. And we'll talk with Sharon Early of Seriously Obnoxious, one of the Food Truck Friday performers this week. That's all coming up with Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, and more right after National Native News coming up on Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today we take a look at Oak Flat in Arizona. Native Americans have camped out in the area to protect the sacred site. Plans are in the works to develop a nearly 3,000-acre copper mine there. Members of the San Carlos Apache tribe are protesting the development. This summer, a group is embarking on a road trip to Washington, D.C. to raise awareness about Oak Flat. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Colorful tents dot the picturesque landscape of Oak Flat on the eastern edge of the Sonoran Desert. For 5 months, dozens and sometimes hundreds of protesters camped here in opposition to the mine. Fernelda Grant is one of them.
We're just here to make sure that we tell the world that this place is significant.
Grant is a San Carlos Apache and the director of the tribe's Historic Preservation and Archaeology Department.
We've been praying here. We've been having our ceremonies. And we've been doing all these things all these years. I don't know, it just makes me want to say, doesn't religion and having faith matter anymore? You know, over money and power.
For more than 400 years, Oak Flat has served as a home, ceremonial site, and even a burial ground for several clans of the San Carlos Apache. Its abundant springs and oak trees made it an ideal place to put down roots. But those roots are sitting on top of one of the largest copper deposits in the world, a mile below the Earth's surface in a place known as Arizona's Copper Corridor. In 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower established protections for Oak Flat to keep the area from being mined for its copper. But an unusual federal land swap last year privatized the area, voiding Eisenhower's order and paving the way for the largest copper mine in North America.
Copper mining built this state, and the economic powerhouse that is Arizona really developed around copper mines back in the day, and this is where God blessed us with copper.
David Richens is a spokesman for Resolution Copper, the company developing the mine. He acknowledges the cultural and spiritual concerns of the San Carlos Apache, but says Arizona's legacy as the leading copper producer in the country can't be ignored.
It's a tough trade-off. It's a tough trade-off. Economic development, you know, and job creation versus, you know, claims.
Representatives with Resolution Copper say over the course of the mine's lifespan, about 60 years, it would create some 4,000 jobs, $60 billion in revenue for the state, and provide a quarter of the U.S. copper demand. Those are statistics that have garnered the support of Arizona Senator John McCain and Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick. But those same statistics have created suspicion for Wenzler Nosey Sr., former chairman and current council member of the San Carlos Apache tribe.
That really blows me away when you have these people making these comments, that it's not holy or not sacred.
Nosey was in Flagstaff recently to deliver a lecture about the cultural significance of Oak Flat. He was joined by about 20 others who beat drums and sang songs for its protection.
How can you argue where there's ceremonial dances happening from the ancient times, children, you know, being baptized in the Apache way, people coming there to be healed?
Development of the mine has yet to begin in earnest. So for now, not only does Oak Flat sit atop an enormous and coveted copper deposit, it also sits at the delicate apex of culture, environment, and economy. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference is celebrating 100 years. The Interior Alaska Native Organization held an event this week to commemorate a 1915 meeting between chiefs and a judge, Alaska's delegate to Congress. The meeting signified the beginning of a formal relationship between Athabascan tribes and the U.S. government. The chief's priorities included education, healthcare, and land protection, which continue to be important issues today. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Hawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by United Tribes Technical College, offering courses online for a career in medical coding and for updating your current coding certification. Registration available through August 10th online at uttc.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Well, as we listen to Word Up by Cameo, we're going to continue our series, Words 101. Pete Griffin and Ann Fuller in the studio with me. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Oh, you bet, Andy.
And let's just start with you. Your approach to storytelling, let's talk a little bit about that. I know that you, of course, I've heard the stuff that you do that concerns the natural world and that sort of thing. You also do stuff that's more personal.
Yeah, yes, I do. I started doing essays on radio down in public radio in Ketchikan, actually, before I moved to Juneau. Natural history essays, things I saw out in the woods, and that graduated into I remember when I was a kid and I used to see these things and didn't know what they are, and gosh, now that I'm older and smarter and more educated, here's the story behind it. And that graduated into purely personal stories, and I've had just a blast with it over the last 5 years.
Do you feel that there's a particular power to storytelling? It's sort of clear there's an art form there.
There is a power to stories. They're very revealing of ourselves and of truths in general. There's a quote. I don't tell fairy tales, but there's a quote about fairy tales I really like. It's that fairy tales are important not that they teach us that dragons are real, but that dragons can be defeated.
That's great. Well, that is true, right? You know, fairy tales are so much about metaphors and those kinds of things. Anne, tell me a little bit about your style of storytelling or what you get into. Twice told tales is what you told me is the best way to kind of start understanding your approach.
Sure. I usually tell stories I've heard before, stories that I've loved. I was really fortunate in that I was at the right age, asking the right questions of my grandmother to get her stories. And so there are things that were passed down that younger cousins missed out on. And I just thought, oh, yeah, everybody knows these. And I found out that it isn't true.
It's so funny. When you said twice told tales, I thought of my grandfather immediately. He was a really amazing storyteller, kind of one of those guys in this very small town in North Carolina who did that. Kids were always gathered around because they wanted to hear these funny things. There was not necessarily a lot of truth in the stories he told, you know, but it was just about entertainment and having fun. And that's really interesting to talk about that connection with grandparents.
Yes, and that the stories that we remember to tell. And so I have told these stories in small groups and from stages. And they're just some marvelous things. And when you realize that it was someone who saw a witch hanged in Salem, and we know that she said, I know I saw that when I was a little girl, but when I looked up there, I just saw an old woman. That she said it, that it was remembered, and then it's been saved for so long. As Pete was saying, there's something revealing in that story that seems important.
And the idea behind actual the oral history and actually presenting it orally in storytelling, to me it seems like it really gets to almost a more primitive state in a way. It seems like what humans have been doing for countless thousands and thousands of years.
The way I had it explained to me once, there were two tribes that were competing, well, millions of years ago. One were the practicals, who spent all their time hunting and gathering and picking berries and just doing that and then going to sleep and start doing it all again the next day. But the other tribe, the storytellers, would, at the end of the day, they would have their meal, they would tell stories to their kids about the day and about the things that were good to eat and where to find them. And those two tribes, of those two tribes, the practicals became extinct. So we are the tribe of storytellers now. And that is how important information was passed down from generation to generation, and it still is today. I tell stories about things that my grandparents pointed out in the woods that were good to eat or not good to eat.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite story that you like to tell? Do you have some couple of favorites? Or
I've got several favorites depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell one about berries that my elders had pointed out as being poisonous when I was growing up, and actually after 50 years of avoiding that berry, finally finding out what it was and the fact that, oh, it isn't really poisonous. It's actually good to eat. So sometimes misinformation
yeah.
gets passed on, too.
But it didn't hurt you not to eat that berry.
No, it didn't. And that was their way of any berry that they weren't really sure about was labeled as poisonous.
Yeah.
And some other story, relationship stories, when I have a lot of time and I can build up to some exciting points in the story. Those are some of the favorites.
How about you, Ann? Mm-hmm. That's a hard question, I know.
That's a hard question.
Yeah.
No, I do think that the stories that of adventure, and I've been exploring recently Alaskan stories. So Marty Murray wrote so beautifully, and then a couple of years ago at the glacier, I put together things I knew with things on the map here in Juneau about Gilkey Glacier. That went. I liked that story a lot.
What do you think is important about? What do you think are some of the key important things about approaching telling a story?
Well, I think the artist finds the story, or the story finds the artist. So at different times and with different audiences, there can be right stories and stories that are going to be harder to get across. So I guess there's some quiet listening. I say listening. I've found that I can now go through story collections and quickly decide what's going to work, what stories I'm willing to work on. Part of that is by the time I've developed a story and created the images in my mind that I'm going to convey with words, I've invested a lot in the story.
It's become yours in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the very first version of A Raven's Tale that I learned from Robert Bringhurst's written version, I definitely felt in the 6 weeks I worked on that one that I had acquired a much more fluid sense of what the world could be and what people did in the world, because it was all about a trickster, what the folklorists call a trickster character, but it was about Yale and how he sees the world. And it definitely changed how I saw the world. But that means it's important to choose a story that gets you where you want to be in seeing the world.
And then, Pete, as you develop from whole cloth stories, I mean, you know, whereas Anne's usually taking interpretations of some existing stories and mm-hmm. adding her own perspective. But what's that process for you where you kind of get the grain of an idea and you kind of think that this is developing into something that could become a more fully developed story?
Yeah, my stories usually develop from an anecdote, just something that happened usually a while back or something yesterday. And I'll think about that, I'll mull it over, and usually that is a small piece in a larger jigsaw of experience, whether it's a puzzling over a flower I've seen and just thinking about it and going through it and oh gosh, that's an unusual Latin name. Oh, I wonder how it got that name. And pretty soon you've got a story about common butterworts, which were used to heel cow's chapped udders, and it's a meat-eating plant that traps insects because it grows in soils that are nitrogen poor, so it traps and digests insects for the nitrogen, and it was thought to protect cows against elf arrows, and on and on, and it's a marvelous thing. And then you go back to the dictionary, and there's a whole part of the dictionary ahead of the A's for aardvark in the origin of languages. And so butterwort is from the term wirt, which is German or Scandinavian for herb. And so the origin of some of the names are it's you can be an adventurer and not even leave your kitchen table.
Yeah, well, that's the key to storytelling and actually then conveying the story. You're taking people on a journey. You're transforming time and the space that people are in by taking them on this kind of emotional and mental journey.
So true, and if when we reach the audience, you're taking your own journey. Like you said, oh, I just remembered about my grandfather, those stories when Anne mentioned her grandparents.
Yeah. What do you think the importance is of having it be told versus just being read? And I mean, reading, of course, has its own incredible value, but what sort of the...
But there's presence and tone of voice and gesture. I even prefer live telling to the idea of recorded telling. And in as Pete mentioned, this idea that it's a human endeavor to tell stories and that we benefit from the stories we tell, I wouldn't want to see it as a frozen art that only some people do and then is broadcast. It's nice to share it with lots of people, but stories change as you tell them, and even when you think you have a description in mind, as you actually speak the words, I've found. Mm-hmm. The words can change, and all of a sudden something else comes up.
Oh, when I'm telling one of my natural history stories to an audience of kids 9 and 10 years old, you can tell when you've got them. You can't tell on the radio, but boy, when you're standing in front of them at the library, you know when you've got them, when their eyes are wide and they are not moving and they're just staring at you. That's a wonderful feeling.
Just as a final thing, do either of you have favorite storytellers that people could maybe pursue or try to find recordings of or try to... Anne, maybe you...
Jay Callahan.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I love that guy.
Well, that's a recommendation to the audience right there. Then.
Jay
O'Callaghan. Both of you are going to say Jay.
Kim Whitecamp, Bill Lepp, they are from the South. Donald Davis does a wonderful job in storytelling of his youth, and just terrific, absolutely terrific.
And so I went to a concert. There are storytelling conferences and places you can go to hear tellers for a long time. And I happened to be at one, and Donald Davis told Hansel and Gretel. He talked about Hansel and how the witch gave him this big plush sofa. There's a big television in front of him, kept plying him with snacks, and he didn't want to leave.
Mm-hmm. That was the trap.
And
that was the cage.
That was the cage. And we all knew it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Ann Fuller and Pete Griffin, are there places people can find your stuff or your storytelling? Or do you have some gigs coming up? Or?
Gosh, I have gigs coming up down south. I tell on the cruise ships now, both Disney and Princess. Gigs this summer in the lower 48. I do have a website, thestorytellingranger.com.
Okay.
And I have CDs that are available there and at the Jack for that.
Terrific.
Yeah. I don't have any
live
recordings
and in person
ready.
Is...
You have to be live and in person, but watch out. I was at the public library in a discussion group. And
all right.
There was an appropriate story to tell, so out it came.
Well, I thought we would... end this up with one of our America's great storytellers as well, Garrison Keillor, with the Writer's Almanac coming up right now. Ann Fuller, Pete Griffin, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge about words in this segment of Words 101.
Thank you.
Thank you.
is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 10th of July, 2015. It's the birthday of Alice Munro, born in Wingham, Ontario, 1931. Went off to the University of Western Ontario, studied journalism, came back home, married, had four children, stayed home to take care of them, and began to write. She said, "I went through a year, I couldn't finish a sentence. It was a time of terrible depression." And then in 1959, her mother died, and Munro suddenly found that she was able to explore her own life in her fiction in ways she'd never been able to do before. And 9 years later, she published her first book of stories, Dance of the Happy Shades, writing about ordinary people, small-town Ontario, where, she said, people's lives, as elsewhere, were dull, simple, amazing, unfathomable, deep caves paved with kitchen linoleum. It's the birthday of Marcel Proust, born in Auteuil, France, 1871. His parents died within a few years of each other, leaving Proust enough money to live without having to work. And so he began his seven-volume work, Remembrance of Things Past, sometimes translated as In Search of Lost Time. The most famous scene occurs early on when the narrator dips a bit of a Madeleine in some tea and experiences a profound sense memory of his childhood, which had actually happened to Proust, although in his case it was not a Madeleine, it was a rusk, a dry biscuit. It's the birthday of Edmund Clara Hugh Bentley, born in London, 1875, author of mystery novels, but famous to us as the inventor of a new form of verse named for him, the Clarahue, made up of two rhyming couplets, the first rhyme, the name of a famous person, for example, George III ought never to have occurred. One can only wonder at so grotesque a blunder. And it's the birthday of John Calvin, born in Picardy, France, 1509, who experienced a religious epiphany sometime in his early 20s and embraced Protestantism at a time when Protestants were being burned as heretics in France, and who left for Switzerland, where he founded what we now know as Calvinism, the five principles that include the belief that all people are born sinful and that God has already chosen those who will be saved. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran entitled The Sound of a Train. Even now I hear one and I long to leave without a suitcase or a plan. I want to step onto the platform and reach for the porter's hand and buy a ticket to some other life. I want to sit in the big seats and watch fields turn into rivers or cities. I want to eat cake on the dining car's unsteady tablecloths, to sleep while whole seasons slip by. I want to be a passenger again, a person who hears the name of a place and stands up, a person who steps into the steam of arrival. A poem by Faith Sheeran, The Sound of a Train, from Telling the Bees, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Well, that's Polyphonic Spree with Mental Cabaret, and we're having an actual cabaret in Juneau coming up. And with us to talk about right now is Laura Haywood, Tom Locher, and all the way from New York City, Terry Lynn LeCompte. Thanks, everyone, for coming in.
Thank you, Andrew.
Great to have you here.
Thanks for having us on.
And tell me a little bit about, you said you'd be able to talk my ear off. Or talk a dog off a leash, is that what you said?
Something like that.
About what Juneau Cabaret is all about. So, Tom, I'll ask you that loaded question. Tell me a little bit about, you've done this for now 6 years.
Yeah, we got our start in 2009. Laura Haywood's the producer, and I've been one of the main accompanists, musical director. We have some other great volunteer accompanists and a whole lineup of good singers. And the next show is coming up this Sunday, the 12th, Rockwell Ballroom at 7 p.m. And that's the old Elks Hall, 109 South Franklin.
So when I look at the concert poster here, you know, you see Juneau Cabaret. It's a beautiful woman on here. Is this a picture of you?
Of course.
Well, you look gorgeous in this. You look gorgeous, of course, standing in front of me as well, or sitting in front of me. But it's a very stylized picture of you. And
inspired.
And then a cast of the luminaries of Juneau talent below it. So how do you collect all these people that get involved in the cabaret?
Well, you know, there's a lot of performers in Juneau. There's a lot of people who like to sing.
It's true.
And Tom Locher is very good at fleshing them out. I have to say that. But just to tell you, we as Tom said, we did get started 6 years ago. And it was my brainchild, and my idea was that I wanted to get my husband a little more performance time, John Haywood. He's a good singer. And I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And then this person, Terry Lynn, from New York City, was visiting, and she had lots of songs up her sleeve, and I said, why not now? So she was the reason we did our very first one at Big Blue, Ron Moss's performance space, and then we grew from there and ended up in Silver Bow, and now we're at Rockwell. And this is Terry. Terry Lynn came in for the one time for the Silver Bow era as well, and she'll perform with us.
Well, Terry Lynn, tell me a little bit about your background and you know how cabaret is something that you got into.
Well, I'm a performing artist in New York City, and I work as a singer, actor, director, educator there. Cabaret, I think of myself as a storyteller, and so cabaret is a place where I can pick stories from all different kinds of genres that tell stories that are interesting to me.
And what's the derivation of this word cabaret, and what makes this different than like just a variety show or just like a vaudeville show?
Well,
or
I think it
like
actually
that.
Is a French term for a small eating establishment, eating and drinking establishment, kind of like a bistro or something. And I think it's World War II kind of derivation. And basically, what it means, we do have round tables. You can eat and drink. You can buy food and drink at Rockwell. And it's a very intimate experience between a singer and a piano, basically, and a pianist, and the audience. So
that's the format, one singer with a pianist. And that's sort of what comes
Except
out.
Except where we break the format. Which
yeah.
Oh.
because it's Juneau, Alaska.
Yes.
We also have a drummer on stage with us. David Shakely will be returning for his 21st Juneau Cabaret performance. And he's a great jazz and cabaret drummer, and he knows exactly what to do. And he plays on about one half of the songs presented. Each singer is up for two songs, and we have a great variety of songs and singers. I was telling Laura this morning, we've had over 90 singers participate in this production in
wow.
6 years and perform over 500 different musical numbers. I've sure had to learn a lot of songs in the time. And it's a great growth experience, and it's great for returning singers, for developing singers, for veterans like Terry Lynn who come into town and can just get up on stage and do a couple of songs. And she's been really fun to work with and accompany this week in rehearsal.
And yeah. Terry Lynn, do you have like some arrows in your quiver as far as like which songs you really know these are okay, these are really great ones that I kind of hit the ball out of the park at every time? Or how do you kind of decide what songs you're going to do?
I do. I have a repertoire book. But this is the first time, Tom and I have been friends for many years, but this is the first time I've actually had the opportunity to work with him as an accompanist. So I tried to pick songs for this cabaret that I thought the two of us would enjoy collaborating on, and it has been a lot of fun. So
cool. And have you guys been in Rockwell for a while now, or is this
it's
the first time?
It's been a couple of years. No, it's been a couple, two or three years now, I think.
It's a cool space, and they've brought that stage out further now, and you know, it seems like it's really perfect for this kind of a thing.
We have like a sound system and lights and stuff like that.
It's a great room for a singing show, and it's a it's a nice space to come and enjoy a pay-as-you-can show that everyone is welcome, your whole family, children. Yes.
So is this something that you have seen happen in other communities as well? Is this kind of thing happening in other places?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, when I have time to travel, I come back to Juneau. So, so I haven't been in a lot of places. I think this is a special community when you have people like Tom and Laura who will spearhead something and really take it on and just nurture it until it grows into the beautiful thing that it is now. I don't think that it's common, though.
Yeah. But, of course, we're just imitating those beautiful cabaret evenings in New York City that we've only read about. And, you know, these little dives where the singer's kind of draped on the piano. And usually there's smoke in those scenes, and we don't have any. Nobody smokes at ours, but, you know, that's kind of what you picture.
It is
late night.
Powerful, isn't it? I happened to wander into a place in Chicago, you know, 20 years ago or something. I can't remember when I was there, yeah. But got to see a really beautiful, wonderful singer and a great pianist, and then that was it. And that was just electric. You know, it was an amazing feeling to get that intimacy.
It's a very intimate experience.
Yeah.
And that's what's so exciting about it and also scary.
And also you really see the play between the musician, the you know, they're both musicians, obviously, but the pianist and the singer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there has to be that really good connection.
And trust.
Right. And so, Tom, when you're dealing with all these different people and having to establish that, does that present challenges, or is that just something that feels natural?
Well, the interplay is as challenging as you want to let it be, but I love to watch the singer work also with their audience and with the drummer. Often the singer has met this drummer for the very first time. I've briefed him on what the song's going to be, and if the singer's working with the audience and the drummer and me, it all comes together, and there's certainly an energy that's traveling back and forth from the audience and back up onto the stage. It's fun to experience that.
And the drummer, is this going to be kind of mostly like brushwork kind
yes.
of stuff? That's kind of that very soft, just
brushwork,
a little bit of a.
But not just swing and ballads. Deborah Smith is performing a bossa swing of one of her songs, interpreted that way. And Erica Lee will certainly have a song where the drummer's busy. Yeah, because that's how she does it.
That's how that works.
Yeah.
Well, tell folks a little bit about some of the how they can get tickets and all that kind of stuff.
This is a pay-as-you-can performance. You're most welcome to donate at the door. And I'd like to just tell you who is, read the names
of
our
performers. Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Because I'm sure people know some of them. Starting at the top, Jack Brandt, Sarah Radke Brown, John Clow, Eve Dillingham, John Haywood, Terry Lynn LeCompte, Erica Lee, Tom Melville, Bobby Mitchell, Heather Mitchell, Deborah Smith, Dan Wayne, Ardeen Womack, and they will be accompanied by, in addition to Tom Loker, Sandra DeLong, Jackie Farnsworth, Beverly Haywood, and, of course, David Shakley on the drums.
That's awesome. Wow, what a great collection of folks. And of course, a great, you know, outside. It's always great to get outside talent.
Yep.
You know, it was really fun,
right.
You know, to have that for us.
And
yeah.
We're in for a treat this time because Erica Lee's mom is in town, and we persuaded her to also perform one song with us at Juno Cabaret, and she's here visiting from Houston, and she picked her song and came by last night and ran it with me, and we're in for a treat, everyone. So please
cool.
come and hear
Can't
Erica
wait.
Lee and her mom Betty.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little surprise one there. Okay, so it's happening Sunday, July 12th. That's this Sunday. It's at 7 p.m. It's at the Rockwell. You can find out more about all this stuff at JunoCabaret.net.
Yes.
And it's a pay as you can, so you know, bring some bucks, folks.
But
go ahead and walk and enjoy. Thanks so much to all of you, Laura, Tom, and Terry Lynn. Thanks for coming
Andy.
In. Appreciate
Thank
it so much.
Much. Je viens entre tes reins. Je vais et je viens.
je me retiens.
That music can only mean one thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Patrice Elmar has
I'm
entered the studio.
And a little sweaty. Kind of turned on.
That's the whole deal. Patrice, thanks so much for coming on short notice. We called you in because we had an opening here. And, gosh, it's so exciting to have you in town. And
it feels like the old days.
And
me and you,
here
you and
with
I.
Federico Posati, who
yep.
is your a person working with you. You're the producer. You're the director on this.
So she's the director. I was the assistant director on her short
okay.
film and the editor.
And now mm-hmm. and you're now working together on another film. Kind of some of it's happening in Juneau and.
Yeah, we're working on a project here in town. We're still, you know, getting it together. And,
yeah,
cool.
You know,
okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm really excited to see you.
I'm excited to see
so
you.
So it's really nice to see you. And congratulations on everything
Thank
that
you.
Happened
yeah.
and graduating and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome and. You're heading to a new gig soon, which
yeah,
is very cool.
I just got hired as a professor at Pratt, so that's great. I can wear elbow patches.
Yay!
My lifelong dream.
Oh, well.
I know. I'm like, Mr. Rogers, I saw what you did, and I'm following it.
And but so like I said, I'm getting ahead of myself because you guys are actually in town for a world premiere event.
Yeah. That's
this is exciting.
Yeah, we're like, New York isn't good enough for them.
Yeah.
Let's come to Juneau.
Right. We're in New York. Do we have a premiere here? Nah. They don't know how to do the rooms here.
Yeah. No. No.
Yeah.
So tell me about this project that you guys worked on and put together.
Well, I was doing a photo project in South Philly, which is a really kind of great-looking place, townhouses. I mean, it's the city that loves you back. You know what I mean? It really is.
Yeah.
And I kept going there, and I met this gal that was a hairdresser, and she's in that stage in her 20s that's just really kind of funky and fun. And I just thought, what the heck, let's, you know, I wrote a script and...
Yeah, you know, very little money, very lots
yeah,
of enthusiasm. And,
yeah. I mean, you're only young once. You can only do this kind
Heck
of crazy
yeah,
stuff once.
Just
one.
Tell me how this comes together. So you, how did you guys first of all meet?
We
in
were in a class together.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeah,
she was like a TA and
mm-hmm.
I was a student. And
okay.
She said she wanted to do the short film, and I was like, you know, if you need, I'm looking for free help.
And you were studying photography, but you were studying film.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of that's a great way to kind of learn what he knows.
Yeah.
And then, but you have this
mm-hmm.
photographer's eye, which is a different way to look at things. So. So how do you go about starting a film project? It just seems like money, number one, just
yeah.
seems like so intimidating to figure that out. So how did you even start with the seed money or anything to get it going?
Yeah, it's especially tough if you move outside New York. If you every
yeah.
time you move a little bit farther, it's the money.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
right.
living in New York City, there's just a bevy of resources, tons of really creative people, and I was also attending Columbia University, where there's a ton of really smart, motivated people that are learning, you know, studying film, and really want to work on a project. And a lot of cinematographers want to work with a photographer because they know that you kind of have their back and are going to do something interesting. So I just had a budget of like $3,000, which is crazy. Most kids that go to Columbia kind of, you know, they have means backing them. You generally spend between $15,000 and $20,000 on your first short film. I just didn't have that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Matt Adams, my husband, was the producer, and we cooked for a week. You know, we catered everything ourselves. We didn't have craft services or anything, but we just had a crew like Federico, who was, you know, became the assistant director, of people that really believed in the project and wanted to make something awesome.
Yeah.
You know.
So, yeah. So, and I guess, you know, some of the expense when you think about film and stuff
mm-hmm.
used to be the film, and now
yeah.
is was this actually in like HD or did you use film or?
No, it was all digital.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
You can't.
There's no way.
Right, no one does that anymore, I guess, right?
It's impossible.
Yeah, right.
And we didn't have, like, crazy camera equipment, so it wasn't even too expensive, like, the storage and everything. It was
right.
That was the good part, is that we had, you know, good equipment, mm-hmm. and that was the cheap part.
And a lot of, am I right in that a lot of your photography is often black and white?
A lot of the work I do is black and white,
and
yeah.
And is this? As
this
well?
Is color.
Okay, so that must have been a different kind
yeah.
of thing for you to think about.
It's great to work in color. I mean, the whole deal with black and white is I can do it myself, and that's just something I believe in, is being in the dark room. And black and white film stock is more affordable. And I, you know, I'm always thinking about how to keep. It's not like I'm making a ton of money doing this thing.
Yeah.
So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, it was great. Philly is just such a dirty, yeah. beautiful town.
Tell me about finding the story in Philly and then and then figuring out that this was actually something that could hold together a movie.
Yeah, so I'd gone there to photograph some friends, and that didn't work out. And I ended up meeting this woman that was a hairdresser. And
they weren't your friends?
Well, she was not my friend at the time.
Okay.
My friends had some other thing happen that weekend, and so I was like, I've got my camera. I came down here. And Mo turned out to be just such a great character. And the place in her life where she's at in this film, you know, I think we all kind of go through this in one way and the other in our 20s, trying to find our identity, trying to find somebody to connect with. And she told me the story about this crazy date she had on OkCupid, and I said, like, we need to make this into a movie because it's unbelievable.
And so this is kind of a mix between, in a way, like almost a documentary style,
yeah.
and then, but it's actually telling something that's a narrative of a recreation almost. So is it treated as strictly a recreation or...?
Well, I mean, it's her house. It's her dogs.
Like, is she aware of the camera, for instance? Or is it something where it truly seems like it's you're
yeah.
capturing acting?
Well, so, you know, like, Cassavetes used a lot of non-actors.
Uh-huh.
And we just, like, she's actually one of the best actors in the movie, don't you think?
Yeah, today? Absolutely. Like, you don't need to do weird stuff. She's just playing herself, and that's working.
Okay, so...
But everything is scripted, so it's like...
Okay.
Yeah, it's a...
Narrative. It's a narrative.
It's a narrative
yeah, yeah.
thing,
yeah.
but it's still... it feels kind of real sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, one of the cool things about Columbia and the MFA program is we had all these hotshot curators and stuff coming in to our studios. We had actual studios on the Upper West Side, and one of my favorite visiting critics was a curator from MoMA's film program, this guy Josh Siegel, and he was like, I'm looking at your photos and I'm seeing stories, like, why aren't you making a film or something? And I thought, well, I don't really know how to do that, Josh, nor do I have money.
Two words come to mind, Josh.
Two words, money and I don't know.
Those aren't the two words I was thinking.
Pay me. But when I met Fede and other people that were into the film program, I just thought, let's do it.
Yeah, well, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really exciting that... people go through these things their whole lives sometimes and think, oh, I'll do that one day, and you don't get to it. So it's great to – it's really a fun thing. And it's interesting that this kind of entered your life. I mean, as a film student, you're, of course, thinking about projects that are films.
Yeah.
But to then be able to work with someone that kind of comes from a different discipline must be kind of exciting, I would
think.
It was
really fun, you know, and we go there and we understand that nobody's really clear idea of how to do this. And it's nice because you don't do it in the same strict way everybody else does it, but you kind of try to figure it out, and you learn a lot.
And I'm guessing it was your idea to bring this to Juno for premiere.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when Patrice approached you with this idea, what'd you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually a coincidence. We just finished editing, and we were like, you know, since we're going in Juno like 2-3
what
weeks.
The heck?
Yeah, I mean, we might as well do it there.
Fun.
Yeah, we'd sort of like booked other things. I mean, the whole thing with this is it takes so much longer than you think it's going to take, like coloring a film, editing
right.
a film, getting the sound right. And we'd booked this other venue in the city. And everyone kept saying, like, oh, when you come back to Juno, you should show this movie. And I was like, I don't know. And,
right. Big
you know,
commitment to make to have it. Yeah. All
well, it's
that.
Kind of embarrassing because it's like the first thing we've ever done. But
yeah.
like what I love about Juno.
That's true, Patrice.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
I don't know.
The first thing you've done, you're bringing back all the families.
Yeah.
Everybody's
yeah.
here.
What I love about Juno is that it's the instant critique.
Yeah. Oh,
you're
yeah.
walking down the street and they're like, hey,
oh,
nice
yeah.
shoes.
Produce aisle of Foodland.
Yeah.
yeah. They'll tell you.
They're like, boy, those glasses aren't working for you.
Yeah. You just walk
you
into
know.
The produce aisle and you hear, I mean, yeah,
yeah.
anyone who does anything
yeah.
public at all, you
the
hear it all.
The honesty.
Oh,
they're
man.
Like, boy, you really bombed on Juno Afternoon.
Yeah,
way
yeah.
to go.
What are you trying to do on Juno Afternoon
yeah.
anyway? They're not paying you,
you
are they?
You have no business.
Yeah, you have no business. So, all right. Well, this is exciting. Now, is this short film, kind of a half hour thing, or how?
It's 12 minutes.
12 minutes. Okay.
So it's relatively painless.
So you're gonna show it like 7-8 times? Or?
Yeah, we're just gonna loop it
over and over again.
Video art. I'm a video artist now.
No sound.
No sound. It's painful.
Playing it on the ceiling.
Yeah.
People find it. They find it.
It's an experience. Either you get it or you don't get it.
So it's happening 9:30. Is that right?
9:30 at Goldtown. It's free.
Saturday.
Okay. You know, we're just
free.
We're encouraging people to maybe like have something to drink there, so you support the awesome stuff that Mark Ridgway and Colette Cost are doing.
Oh, is there going to be some refreshments available?
Yeah, there'll be refreshments available afterward, and we're going to have a Q&A. Which is hilarious.
Very cool. That's very
cool. I'm
going
to wear a beret and smoke the whole time, even though I don't smoke cigarettes.
Right.
Just light up.
And a jacket, but don't put your arms in the sleeves.
No.
Yeah, just over the shoulder.
Yeah.
Just, it's there. It's my jacket. It's
maybe
hanging
there. Maybe a turtleneck. I don't know. I don't know if we'll have time.
That'll be fun. It's
a pretty good Saturday ahead of you there. Well, you guys, all right, we're having too much fun now, so we're going to have to move on here, but thanks so much for coming
in
on short notice.
Great to meet you guys.
Great to meet you, and great to see you again, Patrice, and I'll see you tomorrow night at this really fun movie premiere, ladies and gentlemen, a world premiere the movie named...
Mockingbird, Wish Me Luck.
Mockingbird, Wish Me Luck. It's at 9:30. It's at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. It's free to get in. But
$3.99.
Feel free to buy some popcorn and things like that to help defray the costs, I guess. I don't
overhead.
Know. Overhead.
Operating.
A lot of overhead. And I know that you're a big fan of Bird Note, so I'm playing that next.
Yes.
Patrice, here it is. Coming up next, Bird Note. Patrice and Federico, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
This is Bird Note. An adult black-capped chickadee flies in toward its nest, carrying a beakful of fresh insects. Reaching a long-dead tree trunk, the bird disappears inside the nest cavity it's excavated with its mate and delivers the goods to the impatient chicks within. A moment later, out pops the adult, but once again, it's carrying something in its bill, what looks like a tiny white pouch. Still on the wing, the chickadee drops the object into the vegetation below. The outgoing payload was a fecal sac, a remarkable adaptation found in nesting songbirds. Nestlings, often within seconds of being fed by the adult, excrete waste in tidy little sacs with a gelatinous outer coating. The dutiful parent now switches tasks from meal delivery to waste management. By dropping the sack a safe distance from the nest, the birds tidy the nest while discarding clues a predator might use to detect vulnerable nestlings. The fecal sack. For anyone who's ever changed a diaper, it's a simple solution we can only marvel at. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is scheduled to reopen on Monday, August 10th, and will be hosting Rocky Mountain Hockey School in August and Kim Yore's Power Skating Hockey Clinic in September. More information at juno.org/park/ice rink.
And we're back in the studios here at KTOO, and we're welcoming Valerie. You're holding up your hands like you don't know what...
Well,
what?
Sharon's not sure if she's supposed to put headphones on.
You can? If you don't have to, though.
Okay.
If you'd like to. You want to?
Well, I'll try headphones.
It's radio.
And see how
it
goes.
It's radio. It's fun to do that. We're with Sharon Early and also Valerie Collins here, and we're going to talk about something that's going to be seriously obnoxious. Is that right?
That is correct.
Is that what's going on? Tell me what is going on here. It's one of the Food Truck Friday performances that's happening. So tell me about Seriously Obnoxious.
Seriously Obnoxious is the name of an offshoot of Morally Impoverished. We are an improv team. It's Valerie and myself and Rhoda, who can't be here today.
Rhoda.
Yes.
Looking a little thin these
yes,
days.
Yes, yes, yes. She,
she'd be glad to hear that.
She would, yes. Yes. So we discovered that of the three of us, we have all at one time or another in our lives had it pointed out how seriously obnoxious our voices are. And so,
or
we
our
said,
personality.
Oh my gosh,
or our personality.
That's us.
I am right in that same boat with you.
There we go.
So this is good. I am right. Let's talk.
Well, we're kind of ladies only.
Okay,
right now.
I know. I get it. But.
So, we started working together a couple of months ago. Morley Improvised ran some improv classes last year. And Sharon and I did the first part together. And Rhoda kind of was a newcomer to Morley Improvised. Sharon and I did perform together at the As If Alaska State Improv Festival back in April. And we picked up Rhoda out of the class because she was really similar in personality and humor to us, and it worked really well together. So we're sad she's not able to make it this year or this show with us, but we're going to soldier on because we are improvisers. So what are we going to do?
Something seriously obnoxious.
And we're going to improvise.
So tell me, is there a little bit of a, do you guys have a little bit of a structure around what you do? Is there audience question? And, you know, are there some of those drills that you guys do or
sure.
some of that, that stuff? Yeah, all of it.
Yeah. I mean, we don't do as many, we tend to do a little bit closer to a more of a long form rather than just a quick back and forth short form.
Kind of theater sports is not what we do.
Okay.
We start with a scene, and our characters might change, and the scene may kind of flow into another scene, but we definitely tend to go with a theme that goes through the whole thing. A lot of people, their first exposure to improv was that television show.
Yes,
I'm not
going
to say out loud. And so that's what they think of as improv. But really, there's a lot of improvisation, all sorts of forms. There's dramatic improvisation. There's comedic. There's romantic, which Sharon and I end up in an awful lot of the time. So
tell me improv. Tell me some of those definitions. I mean, is it just as simple as what it sounds like, or is there some sort of a little bit of a tradition and structure around that?
Yeah, you're not going to break improv is what we hear pretty often. There's some rules, and usually what you do with the rules is you wad them up and you throw them right out the window.
Essentially, what it is really all made up. I mean, it's always all made up. And sometimes it feels like it isn't made up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it feels like, oh, well, they had to have had that when they came in the room because look how that flowed, you know. But that's why we rehearse. So,
right.
And we literally rehearse, and we have to, so that we have this sense of how we flow together, how things move together, how to change scenes quickly, how to complement. So it takes a lot of work to rehearse together and become a team. But that's hard to understand because we have no idea what we're going to be doing.
Until that question goes out to the audience and we say, you know, what's something that you'd really hope to see in Juno that you haven't seen yet? And they tell us porcupine,
whatever it is,
you know, whatever
yeah.
it comes out of the mouth of.
Sure.
And you get a lot of answers typically, but one will just really stand out to you and go, that's something that we're going to work with. I love working with Sharon. I was really happy that she wanted to do this with Rhoda and I.
And then your improv, do you get into props a lot? Do you get into pantomime? Do you do, you know, what's...
More pantomime. You know, we talk about physicality where we take on one that stands out in my mind because it just happened a couple of days ago at rehearsal. Sharon and I became bears.
Okay.
And so we walked like
That'll
bears.
Happen.
We talked like bears. We ate things like bears, you know. So you kind of take on those characteristics. It's a lot more pantomime. We don't do a lot of prop work at this point in time.
You'd have to have the props,
right?
So
right,
you
have to have
As a result, we're going to do our show is going to be tonight is going to be a little more what you might say meta. Because we're going to actually have our director there who's going to direct us.
And
so that will be interesting. He will direct.
Yeah.
He will come in and he will talk about things, and then he'll, you know, he'll probably what he'll do is mess with us
oh,
so
yeah.
that you know, so that things that look like they're going too smoothly. Let's see if we can change this up a little bit. And he'll help get
so it'll
audience
be
suggestions
sort of
from,
a play within a play that people will be viewing.
Show within a show.
A little bit of that kind of, it's a little layered now, and so that'll be a nice twist.
Yeah. So which was a little different format than we had been planning on, but again, we're rolling with it. We've rehearsed this twice now, so I think we're good.
This one, and as partners and working before, it's nice to work together. So it is interesting though to know that you do have to rehearse.
Yeah, that's
have to get together.
Yeah,
and
it seems.
Do that.
I'm sure people think, you just get three funny people in a room and you say, thermometer, and they just go. But there are all those techniques, and there's all that stuff, and then there's just sort of like learning each other's chops in a way, right? Like
absolutely.
Jazz musicians or something.
Absolutely.
Exactly. That's probably true. Yeah. Probably very
and something that came very difficult for all three of us was keeping it clean, because we definitely...
Why do you do that?
We're on the blue spectrum of humor in this group. The original name of our group was Dirty Old Ladies, and we changed that kind of through talking to each other a bit.
It's tough. There's a lot of... there might be a lot of kids in the audience, that kind of thing. Yeah, right. You got to...
And we never know who's going to be off one of our
but
cruise ships.
But a 10:30 show could be fun,
Oh, sure, an After Dark show, absolutely. Yeah. We'll let that go.
Yeah, I was speaking of winter, certainly. So, not 10:30 now.
Well, tell me about Food Truck. Is this just starting like now? Or is it starting in minutes? Or when do you guys go on?
We will go on at 6 o'clock. Is
6
our
o'clock,
slot.
Okay.
There's a 5:30 slot. I'm not sure who's in that tonight or if there is someone. We're at 6, and who's at 6:30? It's a
music number.
Okay, all right. Yeah, and this is what they do. They have performers and music and all kinds of fun stuff happening while people are going to the food trucks and getting great food there at the Jack. And it's such a fun event in general that's going on.
And it's great because you show up and you get something to eat, and then you have a complimentary show to go along with it. How much more fun could you have on a Friday night?
That's awesome, right. So seriously obnoxious. Go ahead, coming up.
I'm going to go bowling instead, I think.
Are you? That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to. The show's canceled.
Yeah, we're done.
That's right. You can't do that. The people are now waiting for you. So 6 o'clock is when you guys are going on.
6 o'clock, we'll be there.
And it's going to be seriously obnoxious, and it's going to be happening at Food Truck
Friday.
It's going
to be seriously obnoxious.
Right.
Well, thanks so much for you
guys. Not mildly. Won't be mildly obnoxious.
All right, Valerie and Sharon, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it. And have a great time tonight at the Food Truck Fridays, and seriously obnoxious.
We hope to see you there.
Thanks for having us.
That's a Juno afternoon for today, a fun one today. Thanks to our storytellers, Pete Griffin and Ann Fuller. Also to our Juno Cabaret folks, Laura Haywood, Tom Loker, and Terry Lynn LeCompte. That's happening Sunday night at 7 p.m. at Rockwell. Also Patrice Helmar coming in here with Federico Passati. Their world premiere is happening tomorrow night at 9:30 at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. Go check that out. And Valerie Collins and Sharon Early of Seriously Obnoxious. You can see them in just a couple hours at Food Truck Friday, 6 o'clock at Food Truck Friday happening. My name is Andy Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in today to a Juno afternoon. Great having you with us today. And enjoy your weekend where it's going to be just a little bit rainy. Rain is likely for the rest of tonight. Rain is in the forecast for the next couple of days. And it doesn't look like it's going to clear up till maybe midweek. So, that's what's going on. Southeast Alaska. We had a great May and June, so we're paying for it now. See you guys next Friday.
Hi, this is John Gagin, the host of Wednesday Morning Cross Currents. I listen to KRNN because there's all sorts of music that I like that you just can't hear anywhere else. Jazz, blues, alternative rock. Can't find it anywhere but KRNN, so that's why I'm a fan. Tune in at 102.7 on your FM dial. Thank you.
At the South Carolina State House, a flag that means heritage to some and racist